we're a bit tighter in this room than we are in the other room. So we will, we'll all be friends. I think we're more or less alternating between this room and the Boy Doyle room from day to day. So keep track of the application to tell you where you are. After the confusion, technological confusion of the beginning of last time, I didn't get all the way through chapter one. So what I'm going to do is quickly touch on the last bits of chapter one. I'm going to go over them quite quickly, not talking them in as much detail as they would deserve, because, as I said last time, they are sections that you'll want to go back to in coming weeks. When the point of, you know, why do we make a fuss about time, why do we make a fuss about clocks, becomes a little clearer. So I'm introducing these ideas to you. I want you to have them in your head at this point, but the texture of them will arrive later, I think. So quite promptly, I expect to get on to chapter two in this section. I'm just warning you that this will feel a bit rushed, because I expect you to be going back to this later. The last thing we did, more or less, last time, was talk about this quick question of measuring times. And rather counterintuitively, I said that the only observer of the three involved whose time we are interested in right now, we point out with answering the question, what is the time of this event in this frame? The only observer that's relevant is the observer who was stationary in our frame and co-located with the event. Okay? The driver can ascribe a time to that event, because they were co-located with the event, it was them that was sneezing, and they were stationary in that frame. They were sitting stationary in the car. So there are two frames here, just to drive this point home, two frames here, the motorway and the car. They are both perfectly good frames. Different people are stationary in them, and different people, and there are two people co-located with the event. So the policeman and the driver are both co-located with the event, even though they're in different frames. Okay, so we're imagining the sneeze, the driver, and the policeman all in the same location, even though, you know, because it's a car driving path, they're not literally in the same spot. But for the purposes of this, they are in the same spot. Our watch, up here, standing somewhere else, watching this happen, is not a way in which we measure the time of that event. Partly because if we see that event happen, things like we've got to wait for the light to get to our eye, so there's an extra correction we'd have to apply. But also because, as will become clear, the question of what is the time becomes a complicated question. And we are simply avoiding that question, you know, in a good way, by saying the only time that matters is a time of a person co-located with an event. So I'm saying this again and again and again just to drive it home, that the time at which something happens is the time of an observer co-located with the event. So you'll forget that and get confused, but I've said it to you several times. So bank those up and listen to them in your head in time to come. So that's how we measure time. We make a big fuss about it. How do we measure distance? How do we measure lengths? And this also is something that will become a bit more complicated than you expect. If I wanted to measure the length of this bench here, then there's a variety of ways I could do it. I could get a tape measure, or I could get a meter stick and lay it out. And all, there's also the ways I can think of doing it. But the way you will think of us measuring that is if I get me and a lot of friends line it up along the front here. In previous years, I've made this an audience participation bit. But the front bench. If this is a coordinate frame, if this room is a coordinate frame, then this observer here has, they know, you know your coordinates. That you're this far from this wall, this far from this wall, this far off the ground, and you know the time. Everyone knows their coordinates in the room. And there's another observer at the other end of the bench who knows their coordinates and, you know, and the time and so on. And the way we measure the length of the bench is we arrange beforehand that everyone will look at the bench at a certain time. And everyone, at a certain time, everyone looks at the bench, and the two people who are at the end note down, I was at the end of the bench. And then we subtract their coordinates. Okay? And the length of the bench is this observer's coordinates minus this observer's coordinates. Now that seems a very long-winded way of doing it. But it's very precise. It's very it's precise enough that we can really think through what happens here. Now, it's overcomplicated for this sort of situation where the bench is just sitting there. There are all sorts of other ways we could do that. What about the case where the bench wasn't just sitting there, it was flying through the room? Okay, so it's zooming along at some relativistic speed. How then do we measure the length? What is the length of the bench in that sense? And there's a variety of ways you could think of doing that. But the way that hangs together and the way that is productive for relativity is this. We do basically the same as we did before. So imagine you're all sitting where you are and the bench is moving, moving past you. Okay? So you're standing clear, as it were. And as before, we say, okay, everyone, synchronize your watches. At a certain time, we're going to look in front of our noses. And as this bench flies through the room, everyone goes, do I see a bench in front of me? And depending on where the bench is, some folk wouldn't, some folk would. So we see the first person who spotted who saw the bench in front of them, and we see the last person who saw the bench in front of them, and we subtract those coordinates. And that's the length of the bench in this frame. It seems overcomplicated. But the point, the crucial thing is, at the same time. Okay, so we prearranged what time the observation was going to be made. Everyone made an observation just in front of their nose. Do I see the bench or do I not? And we collected the data afterwards. And that is, the reason why we're doing it that way is because it makes it clear where time comes into it. Everyone made the observation at the same time. With their synchronized watches, and everyone in the room has synchronized watches. Okay, and we can talk about the process of doing that. It's interesting, but a slight parenthesis. And that's and that of the various other options you might think of. That is the way we measure the length. What we'll discover is that gets a bit more that has interesting consequences when it comes to thing moving at relativistic speed. So I'm not going to explore those consequences right now. I'm going to explore them shortly in probably chapter 3, or like more or less lecture 3. But this is the picture I want you to have in mind. We have a number of people standing on a platform. We're going to hear an awful lot about trains going through stations. People are standing on a station platform. They've marked off the coordinates along the platform. So there's the origin of the x-axis is at one end of the platform, and there's a grid marked out along the platform. The two observers are stationary. They're standing on the platform. And the train goes past. At a certain time, the same time, they observe where the train is, you know, where the train is, and the two extremes, the two at the end of the train, subtract the coordinates, and that's the length. That's what we are taking to be the length of the train in that frame. We're going to explore that more in a bit, but I want to log that with you right now as what we mean. We mean a very specific thing. We talk about measuring a length. Any questions about that? Sneak preview: the reason why we are making a fuss about this is because it turns out that the question of simultaneous is what turns out to be more complicated than we thought. We're measuring the end of this train, end of this bench, whatever, at two points which are simultaneous in our frame. It turns out that isn't a frame-dependent thing. That is a frame-dependent thing. It's not a frame-independent thing. Different frames have different notions of what is simultaneous, and that's where a lot of the stuff about length contraction ultimately comes from. So that's a picture of an ancient Chinese odometer that I talked to the observers and their distance measuring sticks. I think that was a sort of imperial distance measurer a while ago. Now, the other thing I want to talk about is clocks. Clocks are nice and simple things, of course. You have one on your phone, on your wrist, or on the wall. We are going to abstract the notion of a clock. A clock is a thing which tells you the time in a nice and complicated way. What is the time? It's a... and this is where the whole thing can start to go off rails, and people get rather philosophical. What is time and all that stuff? Time is a distance. Time is a distance through time. We're going to be very simple-minded about what time is. It's how far in time from something you have moved. And a useful image, I think, is this thing. And this thing is it's called a. Oh, I forgot what the word is. A taffrail log. If you are on a sailing boat and you want to know how far you've sailed, then one way you can do that is tow a propeller behind you, and as it's pulled through the water, it turns, and you discover how much water you've moved through, and you can use that to navigate your position if you don't have GPS or whatever. And that's a picture of a rather old-fashioned taffrail log, and I think it is useful to have in mind the idea of a clock as a taffrail log. A clock tells you how much time you have gone through. And again, this sounds as if I'm making things overcomplicated. You know, how is that a complicated notion? It turns out to be important, and it turns out that we have to be precise about it, because the question of how much time have I moved through is very straightforward from the point of view of being a clock. It gets more complicated when you want to step back and talk about things moving around at speed. So again, I want to lodge that thought in your head. In the next chapter and the one after that, we'll start to use that and see why we have to be so precise about that. So this whole first chapter is a whole bunch of sneak previews. And you may see mention of the clock hypothesis. The clock hypothesis sounds grand. It's just clocks are nice and simple. They don't malfunction. We assume that clocks are working. They don't get suddenly break when they go at high speed or when they're accelerated. That's obviously not true of all clocks, but the clocks that we imagine in our heads for the purposes of this whole study are uncomplicated. And people are careful enough about this whole area that they feel the need to say that. I think almost we're making good progress here. One of the last points is, as you saw last time, are we in the right place? No, we are not. As we saw last time, we can talk of frames. S, say X and Y, and an observer stationary in that frame with an origin there and coordinates X and Y. And we could talk of another frame, S primed, with coordinates X prime, Y primed, and Z prime and T primed. And we presume there'll be observer, one or more observers stationary in that frame, and that frame is moving at speed v in with respect to the frame S along the x-axis. And that is that's a setup. We're going to, you're going to see that diagram again and again and again in one or other variant. Okay, so get used to it. That setup is called standard configuration. So when I say two frames are in standard configuration, that's the picture that jumps into your head. Plus the constraint that at time zero, time t equals zero, that's the time on the watch of the observer in S, the origin of the moving frame, at the origin of the stationary frame, the origin of the moving frame is there as well. So this, sorry, that makes it overcomplicated. The origins coincide at time t equals zero. We set the clocks and set the coordinate systems so that the origins are the same at time t equals zero. So at time t equals zero, t prime is equal to zero as well, and the two origins are at the same place. Okay, so that's the setup that everything else, all the equations we end up using, not too many of them, presume. Okay, and so there is basically there's approximately. In round numbers, there's approximately one relativity question that comes in the exam. It's, here's a puddle, cast it into standard configuration, here are some coordinates, extract from the puddle the coordinates of the various events, identify the events, work out what those coordinates are in the other frame. That's what so many of the exercises are about, is basically what a lot of the exam questions are about. You'll see that again and again and again. And it sounds, why is that important? You might ask. Do we have to worry about the coordinates of this event in two different frames? That specific problem, no. But that's the tool that we use, the mental tool we use to work out things like the way that relativistic momentum works, relativistic force, relativistic energy, and so on. So that toy problem, in a sense, is the one that drives all the other things. So step one of all of those variants of that more or less same puzzle is draw a diagram, put it in standard configuration. Okay. So again, you'll see this lots and lots of times. I'm saying it now to say it's important. Make sure you're more or less have that more or less right way up in your head. Okay. That's the definition of that. I'm also going to mention, I hope I made clear last time, the notes and the lectures are the same material, just delivered in different ways. I hope the lectures are a bit more vivid than the notes, but the notes are more, more careful. The precise wording is quite carefully thought through and revised from year to year based on what people have found puzzling. So there's a sort of fast and a slow stream of the material. But another source of material is books. The library has books. Wonderful thing. The web has stuff on it. Not all of it's equally good, but I will mention a couple of books which are on some of which are on short loan in the library and are available for as e-books. So if you go, I see that there's a link in the Moodle to a book list, which in the notes to a book list, which it was actually turns out to be out of date last year's, but on the Moodle. You'll find a link to the book list, books at the library or something it's called. And that's a link to recommended books and including electronic texts. The Carolyn Ostley is the A2 course recommended book. It talks about relativity. It's not wrong. I don't find it terribly exciting, the way it talks about relativity. And it makes some slightly suspect notational changes. But still worth reading to get a different way of making sense of this. Tyrone Wheeler is an excellent book. It's a book, though, it's worthwhile looking through that. It's a book you read all of, though, more or less. I think it's a great book, but a bit of a proposition. That book, Rindler, if you start getting puzzled and about the deep subtleties here, what is time and so on, then I might well refer you, say, go and have a look at that. I might, in the notes, point you to bits of Rindler, because Rindler is very careful about things like that. So it's a book that goes on to, well beyond this course, but for deep things, that's useful. The book called French, which is very old-fashioned, but in possibly quite a good way. I think in a quite different way from me. There's a long way of saying, read other things. I think the way I teach relativity is the best way, but that's because the way it makes most sense to me, and I am not you. I hope you will agree that the way I teach relativity is a good way, but other views are possible. I encourage you to find other ways of thinking it through. Be aware, though, there's more than one route in. Not all of them are completely compatible, and there are a few notational differences. So just be a bit alert to that when reading other sources. okay, that's the end of last week's lecture. While I go on to chapter 2, are there any questions? Anyone has any worries, any thoughts? Okay. I'll take that as my eyesight isn't terribly good, but I don't think anyone would put their hand up. I'll shout. I don't mind audience participation within limits. Okay. So, I mentioned last time that the entire physical content of this course comes down to two axioms. And by physical content, I mean things about our universe that could be otherwise. So mathematical statements are, and we omit a bit of the philosophy of mathematics here, mathematical statements are true if the things that they are based on are true. So there's a logic to maths. You can't, if you agree with this statement, then this deduction from it you can't disagree with. So those are mathematical statements. Physical statements are things about our universe that could be otherwise. So gravity, F equals ma, for example. You can imagine a universe where that wasn't true. And before Newton, Aristotle did imagine a universe where that wasn't true. And everyone went, oh, that's fair enough, that's clear how it works. So Newton's first law, Newton's second law, Newton's third law, was making a statement about the world. He was making a statement, this is about how our universe is, although it could be otherwise. And the two axioms are relatively interesting because the physical content of it is so tiny. A large chunk of the relativity you're going to learn for the first five chapters, say, consists of just these two bits of physical information. And that's amazing. I mean, relativity is weird. In that most, most physical theories, version one of them, when they were first produced by Newton or Galileo or Maxwell or whoever, are largely unintelligible. And if you go back to the original papers, they don't make sense. Because folks since then have gone, I know that's a really weird way of explaining it. Here's a much better way of explaining it that turns out to be a much more productive way of doing so. So the original version of Maxwell's equations, which underlie all of electromagnetism, are unintelligible. You can't read that paper unless you're a historian of physics, basically, because it just doesn't make sense. Why would you even think of it that way? Relativity is, I think, almost unique in that the Einstein's 1905 paper is still basically readable. And that's 120 years ago. Einstein's version one of relativity was basically that's it done. And that's very strange. I mean, and that, in a way, is what makes Einstein weirdly good. That he got the right answer from the very beginning. All the stuff about trains as well. Everyone talks about trains with theoretical relativity because it's a very convenient. It's a great example to use. Einstein did that first in a popular book talking about relativity. It's enough. You know, enough. Fandom. So, two axioms and the consequences. Objectives, blah, blah, blah. And I want to say that we talk about Einstein's special relativity. The principle of relativity, which is axiom one, was not Einstein's, but Galileo's. And in the notes, I quote a passage from Galileo's, I can't remember which book it was, which is a long passage where he describes imagining being below decks in a ship with all sorts of stuff, including balls that you could roll around, small animals, whatever, and they all do their thing. And if the boat then starts sailing out, so it's moving at a constant speed, everything works as before. And Galileo said, oh, that's actually quite significant. That's telling us something about the world, that you can't tell you're moving. And that is that Galileo's relativity principle is axiom one, if you like, of Einstein's special relativity, that you can't tell you're moving. And so if we say that same thing, and we pin down your intuitions in the terminology we're just starting to use here, we're saying that if you describe physics, describe a physical process like someone throwing a ball, using the coordinates of someone standing on the harbour, the ship goes past, then someone on the boat could be throwing a ball from hand to hand. And it's Newton's laws work perfectly well. Things work, going a parabola, blah, 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 blah. You know how to do that sort of stuff. And so you could describe it perfectly successfully using the X coordinate along the harbour or the train platform and the time on your watch. And the person in the boat or on the train platform or on the train throwing the ball from hand to hand could do exactly the same thing. They could also describe what's happening using Newton's laws, but they would be using the coordinates x prime, which are the coordinates attached to the boat. And both of these are good descriptions. And it's very easy, if you know one of these, to work out the other one. Because for this boat in standard configuration, because the frame is moving at speed v along the x-axis, for any event, the x prime coordinate of that event, say the observer clapping the hands, the x prime coordinate of that is the x coordinate of that minus the distance that the thing has travelled. I mean, this sounds insultingly obvious, okay? I'm not telling you anything sophisticated here. I'm telling you something you are very familiar with. I'll say that a lot of times as well. One of the ways people get confused about relativity is they hear something like that said, and they think, oh my God, that must be more complicated than I thought. It's not. What I'm doing there is I'm describing something you do understand, that you understood when you were in school, but I'm using the terminology of, this rather elaborate terminology of changes of frames and standard configuration to do it. So what I'm doing is I'm getting you to translate something you already understand into slightly different conceptual notation. Okay? So I'm not telling you anything funky there. Right. And this transformation of coordinates is known as the Galilean transformation. But Galileo didn't call that. And no one called it that until after people talked a little bit relativity and found they had to give a name to that perfectly obvious thing, that perfectly obvious transformation of coordinates. Okay, so when I talk about the Galilean transformation, I just mean that, the obvious thing. And that is the Galilean transformation written out. Again, it looks like I'm making a quite a meal of this. the x prime coordinate, so the coordinate of this event in the moving frame is that. The y prime coordinate, how high up it was, blah, blah, blah. They're the same, time's the same. The speed of the ball being thrown, if I throw a ball from the back of the ship to the front, or the back of the train to the front, then its speed in the train and its speed as viewed by the station platform are going to be different, not surprisingly. And they're different by that amount. You know, the speed on the train is the speed on the platform minus the speed of the train. Not a big surprise. Nice and simple. Too simple even to writing down. So, relativity principle is axiom one. Quick question. Suppose I have a fancy new cosmological theory that says the special point in the universe, say halfway between here and Andromeda, and the gravitational constant G changes depending on how far you are from that point there. So there's a sort of, I don't know what you call it, but that's my wonderful idea. This solves dark matter, if the gravitational constant varies according to the distance from this special point. Does that idea have a chance of being right? Who would say it has a chance of being right? Who would say it doesn't have a chance of being right? Who hadn't put their hands up yet? Have a wee chat between you. But whichever way you think that could be, why? Okay, how many folk would say that idea is a goer? How many would say it couldn't work? Okay. Now, the reason it can't work, because if that worked, it would violate the relativity principle. So that relativity principle, that axiom, you can't tell you're moving, has already done some work. Why does it violate the relativity principle? Because if that theory were true, then what you could do is measure big G. It's not very easy, but you could measure big G and find a value for it. And then you sort of think, what was it, wander about a bit, and you measure it again. I think, if I didn't get it right the first time, you measure it again, and it's changed. Now, either you've made a mistake in your measurement, or you've got closer to this magical point in halfway between Andromeda. In other words, you'll be able to tell you were moving. So the relativity principle says, there are multiple ways of reframing the relativity principle. And one of the books I point to in the bibliography is a book about the relativity principle. About how you can think about this and what its consequences are, just that one axiom. So it's already doing work just by saying that, because it effectively says all coordinate frames are equal. You can't pick one that's special, and you can't pick one that's absolutely moving. So it's useful to think back on that and think. I think that looks rather a silly question, but it's a very productive question. Things to puzzle about, but if you make sure you understand why the relativity principle is getting there. The other thing that's important is the idea of. This is not. I'm not going to get through all this chapter. I'm going to have to go faster. I said that we can analyze physics in one frame and equally well in another. We'll get different numbers. The velocity of the ball, of a thrown ball, will be different in these two cases, but they'll be the same. But they'll be the same physics. It'll be the same equation. For example, the constant acceleration equations are just x prime equals ut plus a half a t squared, as you doubtless recall. So x equals ut plus half a t squared. If I now apply the Galilean transformation to that, I will get, so that's x equals x, x prime equals x minus vt, and we end up with, what is it, vx equals v minus v. Then we say that x equals x prime plus vt be equal to ut primed plus a half at primed squared, because remember that the t prime equals t was one of the other equations of the Galilean transformation, or x prime is equal to u minus v t primed plus a half a t prime squared. So what I've done there is I have changed frame. I changed coordinates using the Galilean transformation equations. I've gone from the description of this accelerated motion in the platform frame, or the harbour frame, whatever, to the description of the same motion in the train frame. And I've got an equation which is different, because it has a different speed here, but has the same form. In other words, the explanation of this, the constant acceleration equations work just as well in the two frames. It's as if I just swapped, added primes to everything. And that looks, well, you're going, well, duh. Why is that surprising? It's not surprising because you intuit quite a lot of the relativity principle. But the point being that the important here is that the description of the physics that's happening as described by an equation in the platform frame, and the description of the physics that's happening as described in the train frame are the same. The equation has the same form. The numbers are different because the velocity has picked up a term from the speed of the frames, but the form of the equation is the same. And that turns out to be that's your first look at a deeply important principle. If you're going to do general relativity in fourth or fifth year, if you stick with this area, then that becomes the principle that guides essentially all of general relativity. The fact that the form of the equations has to stay the same in different frames. It's basically a way of saying the coordinates you pick don't matter. They're just a calculational tool. So the next thing that's interesting here is you've heard of Maxwell's equations, is that right? Yep. Is that right or is that wrong? I saw some nods there, but they were slightly. I'm not going to ask you questions about them, but you've heard of them, and good. They describe electromagnetism. So they unify all of the electric and magnetic laws that were developed through the 19th century, and that's a way of writing them down. I'm not going to say, that's math beyond what you're comfortable with, but they are nice. Maxwell's equations are great. They were developed during the 19th century, and they were found very quickly to be okay. That's the answer. That's how electromagnetism works. But there's a problem, which is that the speed of light is sort of built into those equations. And people discovered that if you do the Galilean transformation on Maxwell's equations, and that's a mathematically quite intricate thing to do, but that's not the point. If you do this transformation, then what you get afterwards is the Maxwell's equations. In other words, what that appeared to be saying was the Maxwell's equations didn't work when you were moving. But what that means is that you can tell if you're moving. Because if that were true, then you could just do an electromagnetic experiment, and if Maxwell's equations work, then you're stationary. If they don't work, then you know you're moving, and that breaks the relativity principle. And folk were disturbed by this, because that's clearly not right, because a radio still works when you're moving. Light still works when you're moving. That's electromagnetic radiation. So there was a big problem at the end of the 19th century. And this was highlighted in the very first sentence of Einstein's 1905 paper. It is known that Maxwell's equations, as usually understood at the present time, 1905, when applied to moving bodies, leads to asymmetries which do not appear to be inherent in the phenomena. That's a long way of saying they break. It looks like Maxwell's equations don't work, is the problem. So, at this point, there were four possibilities. Either Maxwell's equations is wrong. Perhaps, good try, didn't work. One possibility. Perhaps the relativity principle is wrong. Perhaps you can tell you're moving in some circumstances. But that seems that's not a comfortable notion, because that seems so fundamental to our idea of how the universe works. Perhaps the Galilean transformation is wrong. Perhaps this thing here, perhaps there's more to it than that. Perhaps there's some new physics happening here. And the answer, you will not be surprised to discover, is Maxwell's equations are right. The relativity principle is right. It's the Galilean transformation that's wrong. And special relativity is the new physics that comes out of this. So this, it turns out, is this bit that's wrong. Our assumption that was how you went from one frame to another. That's the bit that broke. To everyone's surprise and horror. Relativity was adopted as the answer, and everyone's agreed, oh, that's clearly the right answer. In a remarkably short time, it was about a decade it took for basically everybody to be on board with saying, right, that solves the problem. There were holdouts for a long time. And there's an interesting story to talk about the holdouts, but the acceptance was in fact very swift. And in that paper, Einstein goes on to talk about examples of the sort, together with unsuccessful attempts to discover any motion of the Earth relative to the light medium, and this is the idea of the ether, because with one of the ways of making sense of Maxwell's equations and the Galilean transformation was to say, Maxwell's equations only work in this, there is a reference, an absolute reference frame, sort of, which is this idea of the ether, which is the thing that electromagnetism wiggles in the same way that water waves wiggle on water, electromagnetic waves wiggle in ether. And it had strange properties, which didn't really make a lot of sense, and blah, blah, and there's another long story there. But it was experiments such as the famous Michelson-Morley experiment, which you may have heard of, but we're not going to talk about. We tried to actually detect that movement in the ether, and failed again. And everyone was going, "Well, this can't fail. This can't be wrong." But that is what is being referred to here. And Einstein then, in that paper, upgrades this principle of relativity to not being just a statement about mechanical motion, but about to say all inertial frames are equivalent for the performance of all physical experiments. So there is absolutely nothing you can do. It's not just that this works for mechanics, for trains going through stations. It works for all of physics. There's no physical experiment, there's no chemistry experiment, no biological experiment, no social experiment that you can do that works differently when you're moving. And that is a very bold statement. It's saying we're not talking about electromagnetism here. We're not talking about mechanics here. We are talking about all of physics, is what Einstein is saying. This will be a point to finish on. So I'm standing here. I've got a friend moving past me in a rocket. So at some huge speed, let's say, a very high speed. And I observe her watch to be ticking slower than mine. Let's say it's a good, you know, it hasn't magically broken because of the rocket. But and let's not worry how we observe that that watch ticking slower, because that's also the slightly complicated thing. But one way or another, I observe that her watch to be moving more slowly than mine. I'm going tick, tick, tick. She's going tick, tick, tick. Now, these windows are two-way. She can look and see my watch. Okay? And she, would she see my watch moving faster than hers or slower than hers? Who would say she'd see my watch moving faster than hers? Who would say she'd see my watch moving slower than hers? Who hadn't put the hand up yet? I mean, I'm not taking notes of who puts the hands up. The reason I want everyone to put the hand up is because I want you to guess one way or another, just to try to commit yourself. So in the last couple of minutes, just talk to your neighbours about what that should be. Okay. Ask, think of the question again. Hooks. Her watch is moving slower than mine. Who would say she sees my watch moving slower than hers? Who says she would see my watch moving faster than hers? Okay, fairly evenly split there. The answer is that although there's clearly quite intricate thing to analyse, the watch must be moving slower. So I see her watch moving slower than mine, and she must see my watch moving slower than hers. Because if she didn't, then one of us would know which one was moving, and that would violate the relativity principle. And that makes no sense. I mean, come on. How can my watch be moving faster than hers and her watch moving faster than mine? That's so we haven't even got to the second axiom yet. Already the first axiom is telling us this extraordinary thing about time, that we can the two of us can make observations of each other's clocks and come to opposite conclusions about what's happening. And this sort of thing is why people go, no, relativity can't be right. That doesn't make any sense. Oh, my God. It does, but you have to be quite careful about what questions you're asking. Because I said, let's not worry about how we measure her watch. There's a lot of missing out there. Okay? And so it's when we ask the question, what do you actually mean by measuring the other person's watch? That's when you discover you can step through this and you can come to something that does make sense and hangs together. And that's what we're going to be doing starting in chapter 3. I have the other half of this chapter to go, but I will be, I think, disciplining myself about timekeeping more. So I'll see you. It's either next Wednesday or next Tuesday, whatever it is. See you next time.